Now, bringing Southern California together for nearly five decades, this is Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. 95.5 KLOS. Now, Spotlight on the Community with Doug McIntyre.
Crunch time on a financial problem in Washington that could result in a government shutdown, and it's all embroiled in the controversy over illegal immigration and the DACA deal. And to talk to us about where we stand on this, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show one of the people we've been talking to about this issue for years and years and years. It's a pleasure to welcome Congressman Tom McClintock. Good morning, Congressman. How are you?
Good morning, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I really believe that this is a golden opportunity, and it will be a real tragedy if we bungle this. And I know that the Democrats and people have been making a big deal over the president's use or non-use of offensive language related to Haiti and Africa. But I find it hard to believe that that's the reason why this deal is falling apart.
Well, no, it's falling apart because the Democrats do not want to take the measures that are necessary to secure our borders as we legalize 800,000 people who came here illegally. And that's a big problem because we can't address DACA, the young people illegally brought here as children, until we secure our borders. Otherwise, we're just going to encourage more people to illegally bring their children.
We've talked about this many times before. This is exactly what happened after the Simpson-Mazzoli bill. We were promised border security. We didn't get it. They got an amnesty, and then people lined up for the next amnesty, and we'll do it again. Well, this is the back of the shampoo bottle. We'll be shampoo, rinse, repeat. We'll be doing this again in 5-10 years, talking about a different number of people in the country illegally.
That's exactly right. So when we address DACA, we absolutely have to take the provisions that are necessary to secure our border, restore the integrity of our nation's sovereignty, and so that we're not dealing with an even bigger problem. You mentioned Simpson-Mazzoli. When Reagan signed that, he legalized 3 million illegal aliens in the country in return for the promise of border security that we never got. Now we're dealing with a vastly larger problem.
From your perspective, is it possible to make a deal on this? Because it seemed like, at least during the televised negotiation, which was some kind of bizarre political theater, everybody was on their best behavior. And it looked like, well, everybody's dealing the cards face up. The Democrats weren't being deceptive. They were saying they wanted a clean bill on DACA, which is basically saying we wanted to have amnesty for the DREAM Act kids without any border security provisions. And the Republicans were correctly pointing out that, no, we've been down that road before. That doesn't work for us. So everybody understood to give a little, we're going to have to get a lot. We're going to have to give a little each side. But it seems to me that tactically, the president's loose lips have made it harder for people to do business with him because of the resistance movement. The idea that you do any deal whatsoever with the president on this is to be, and I'm using their rhetoric just to emphasize the political conundrum, that you're doing business with a racist. And therefore, the Joe Manchins and the people who might be willing to cut a deal with the administration on this issue and have real border security built into it either won't do it, or they've been badgered by the Democrats who want to have the issue to run on in the midterms in 2018.
Well, I think whatever was said in that meeting, the Democrats are simply using that as a pretext. The fact is that they were in full resist mode from the day after the election and haven't changed that posture. They are the ones demanding that we legalize the DACA participants. Republicans are saying, fine, we're willing to do that, provided that we fix the problem at the same time. I think the American people want to see this problem solved, not perpetuated.
Can I ask you a couple of questions that just baffle me? Why doesn't the president has a bully pulpit? He's got the ability to drive the news cycle like nobody we've seen in maybe in our lifetimes. Just a few words tweeted out, and the news media goes into meltdown. Why doesn't he ask for network news time? And have a speech written that he can deliver that lays out the argument and puts heat on them instead of just sniping around the periphery. Why not? This is his signature issue. This is the issue that lit the fuse on his candidacy when he came down the escalator at Trump Tower in 2015. Why not talk to the American public and rebut some of these nonsensical emotional arguments that are thrown out there and facilitated by the L.A. Times, etc.?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. It's a very important question. It arises from that basic question of, you know, what would Reagan do? I remember William F. Buckley talking of George W. Bush saying, well, poor George, words just aren't his thing. And I'm afraid that televised presidential addresses are not Donald Trump's thing. And I don't know what to do about that. I agree with you completely. I think that the case is a strong one. It needs to be made clearly, not through tweets or misrepresentations of conversations that went on in the White House, but rather a solid, reasoned statement to the American people. I don't know why they're not doing that over there. I wish they would.
Yeah, I mean, because frankly, without that, in the absence of presidential leadership on this issue, the field is ceded to the advocates of open borders, because they're going to have not only the emotional argument. You know, there was a very dramatic story about this guy in Detroit who had been in the country for 30 years who was deported, is Jorge Garcia, 39 years old, a landscaper from Lincoln Park, Michigan, deported on MLK Jr. holiday to Mexico. And very dramatic footage of him, tearful goodbye with his family, et cetera, et cetera. And those stories are going to be all over the place. The media will be happy to air them. And there's no rebuttal argument. And that's where the vacuum has to be filled. Otherwise, this is going to be a lost cause.
Well, exactly right. And the media is biased to a level I've never seen in my lifetime. Which makes it all the more important for the president to speak clearly on these issues and not tweet them out, and then you know, allow the press to distort them and attack them.
We're talking with Congressman Tom McClintock, who you can follow on Twitter at Rep McClintock, R-E-P McClintock. Is this inexorably tied to the financial deal to avert a shutdown? And if so, what does that portend for a government shutdown?
Well, the government shutdown, if it happens, I place at the hands of the Senate Republicans, who now for several years have refused to reform their cloture rule, which gives the Democrats veto control over any bill that's taken up, including the appropriations bills that the House sent to them back in May. They can't take those bills up because Chuck Schumer and the minority Democrats are blocking it. They're able to block it because the Senate Republicans continue to give them that authority by refusing to reform their cloture rule. That's the fundamental problem there. So we're now reduced to these continuing resolutions that provide authority to spend for limited periods of time. That's also subject to the cloture rule, and that is giving Schumer and the Democrats the ability to hold the government hostage over their unrelated demands on DACA.
Now,
how's that going to come out? I don't know. I think the House is going to pass a stopgap measure through February 16th, send it over to the Senate, and see if the Democrats really want to shut down the government over a demand to legalize 800,000 illegal immigrants who are currently in this country without any reforms to assure that we don't repeat this process.
The cloture rules, is Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate hanging on to this because they certainly used it when Barack Obama was president, and they feel like, well, that's a tool in the toolbox we may need in the future, and therefore we're going to hang on to it even if we pay a price for it now?
Well, that is the argument they will make. The counter argument is that, you know, if they think they're preserving this for their fast approaching time in the minority, they're mistaken, because Chuck Schumer and Harry Reid both made it clear when they thought they were going to take the majority of the Senate in 2016 that the first thing to go would be the cloture rule. So the Republicans aren't preserving that for some future time. That as soon as the Democrats take control, they're going to reform cloture. They'd be fools if they didn't.
And the other issue is, and this is where we'd like to get a little insight into the thinking in D.C. from this great distance. there's what's in the interest of the country, and then there's what's in the interest of parties, and there's what's in the interest of individual politicians. And it's hard not to wonder if, when it comes to a government shutdown, if there isn't a political calculus going on right now where people are literally market testing to see who's going to take the blame if the government shuts down. Because we know in the past, the blame sticks to the Republicans. And again, the media will be more than happy to blame Trump for his stubbornness on DACA, et cetera, not the Democrats. So will is that what's being discussed? Are there Democrats trying to think, look, if we go to the wall on this, we energize our base, we can go to the resist people and say we're resisting. It'll help us in November. And our friends in the media are going to pin the tail of blame on him.
Well, it certainly worked for them in 2013, so I'm sure those calculations are being made right now. Perhaps the one silver lining in this may be that that is the straw that breaks the camel's back over cloture and compels the Senate Republicans to say, you know, this just isn't working anymore. We're not going to tolerate the shutdown of the government by a minority of the Senate. We're going to reform the cloture rule, fund the government, and move on.
If this moment in time passes, because I do believe that with all of his faults, what Donald Trump has brought the country is an opportunity to fix our broken immigration system in all its many component parts, because he's been willing to take the heat, which a lot of other presidents have not been willing to take. They've either wanted to go along with it or they wanted to be compassionate conservatives and have acts of love, et cetera, et cetera. But if this window closes, where do we go from here?
Well, very important question. The central mandate that the American people gave this government in 2016 was to revive the economy. We're well underway of doing that. The new tax bill, I think, is going to be a major improvement on economic growth. Secure our borders was also a mandate. What happens if we fail? Well, then our borders mean nothing, and history warns us that countries that cannot defend or will not defend their borders simply aren't around very long.
As always, we appreciate your time and insight. Congressman Tom McClintock, at Rep. McClintock on Twitter, thanks so much for being with us. We always appreciate it.
My pleasure, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Okay. We go to the city of San Francisco. The homeless problem, which is we've spent so much time talking about here in Los Angeles, but this is a California problem. It's a global problem, but it's particularly acute in California cities. And there is a software engineer up in San Francisco who designed a map that maps the city by the bay's most poop-ridden neighborhoods.
What? Huh?
Yep.
Oh, boy.
It's called Human Wasteland, and the designer is with us right now. It's a pleasure to welcome software engineer Jen Wong. Jen, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing pretty good. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you for coming on. And the website is mochimachine.org/wasteland, MOCHIMACHINE, mochimachine.org/wasteland. How did you come up with the idea, and what's the purpose?
Sure. So I actually was participating in a Hack Week at a previous workplace, and I found this data set on DataSF. It's a bunch of public data that's made available to anyone who has an internet access. And I was just like, I just need to do something with this data. It seems kind of crazy that we have it. And essentially what it is a bunch of reports of supposedly human waste, because I'm not really sure how you'd be able to test that.
Or why you would want to.
Yeah, exactly. And those are made to 311 in San Francisco.
Now, the city of San Francisco is notoriously bohemian and inclusive and tolerant of alternate lifestyles. And it's been that way for a very, very long time. It's that way back to the days of when Mark Twain was living there in the 1860s. But there is a point where people just get fed up. Is that what we're seeing here?
So I think particularly with this report, I think, yeah, maybe frustration coming from people. And I think that was seen in the 2016 voting, and then also in the 2010 voting, where both, I think, there was a sit-lie ordinance, which was Proposition L, passed in 2010. And then in 2016, Proposition Q, which was the tent clearing measure, mm-hmm. that actually passed as well. So I think that kind of shows some of the frustration that's happening. But, I mean, Prop Q only passed by maybe a couple of percentage points. So
we're talking with Jen Wong, who is a software engineer, and her website maps the purported human waste, the neighborhoods and the streets in San Francisco with the most poop. Is there one that's like the king of poop up there? Is there a is there one neighborhood that is hands down the most pants down?
So based on the data that I found, that would either be the Tenderloin or the Mission districts, most likely.
And nobody seems to have a solution to this problem. We certainly don't in L.A. and in Los Angeles County. Voters approved a sales tax hike, and the city of Los Angeles voters approved a sales tax hike, two sales tax hikes, in order to deal with the homeless. And yet we're still faced with an identical situation right outside this radio station. I mean, not 50 feet from our front door is a van with a person who's been living in it. She's been living in that van for I don't know how long, but she lives on a public street. At least she has the van. But this is an epidemic in California. Nobody seems to have an answer. Have you had communication with the people using your website? What's their attitude about it? Are they just interested in cleaning the streets? Are they interested in trying to find a permanent home and a solution here?
So I've never spoken to anybody who's actually made a report about this. I'd say that most of the people who are looking at my site find it humorous. And I actually honestly was surprised that it kind of struck a chord with many people. And I was asked to comment on the homelessness issue in San Francisco quite a bit. And
Did you mean it to be humorous? Did you mean it to be humorous?
I did, and I would say that I have a little bit of regret around that, but it has also brought a lot of attention to the issue of homelessness, and so I'm happy that it's actually gone that way, because it's a problem that needs to be solved for sure.
There are some funny parts of this site, though, like the search feature is, "Will I step in poop? Type in your address."
Well, listen, it's a real urban problem. When I used to work the overnight shift here many years ago, I would come down La Brea to Washington and then take Washington over to La Cienega. And there was a regular parade of poop going on where you just see people dropping trowel and squatting on the curb in the middle of public streets. And it got to the point where people just didn't even respond to it. I think that's partly when the abnormal starts to be considered normal, that's when we've got a problem. And that's sadly what has happened in many cases, because people feel frustrated that they don't have an answer and the cities oftentimes are non-responsive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. In San Francisco here, so obviously people not having facilities is the main problem for what the map's about. And so there is actually a pilot program going on in San Francisco that's providing supervised access to toilets. And so those are posted up in different locations around the city. I'm not sure how the program's gone so far, but I think it's great that that's something they're trying to do. I don't think it fully resolves the issue of homelessness, obviously, but it does kind of alleviate the issue of facilities and access to that.
Yeah, Do you think we need to start passing out doggy bags to all the homeless people?
Or maybe we need another website that just lists all the public bathrooms that are available so that people can. Well, then again, the chances that the homeless are going online to find bathrooms isn't too good, as long as the streets are available and the city tolerates it. Hey, listen, Jen, thanks so much for coming on with us. Again, the website is mochimachine.org, mochimachine.org/wasteland, with an emphasis on waste. Dr. Dahlia, welcome aboard. Dr. Dahlia, how are you?
Hey, good. Thanks for having me.
So yesterday, Dr. Ronnie Jackson is the White House doctor. He did the exam on President Trump, and he was out to face the press and said the following.
The president's overall health is excellent. His cardiac performance during his physical exam was very good. He continues to enjoy the significant long-term cardiac and overall health benefits that come from a lifetime of abstinence from tobacco and alcohol. We talked about diet and exercise a lot. He's more enthusiastic about the diet part than the exercise part, but we're going to do both. The reason that we did the cognitive assessment is plain and simple because the president asked me to do it. We picked one of the ones that was a little bit more involved. It was longer. It was the more difficult one of all of them. It took significantly longer to complete, but the president did exceedingly well on it.
Now, here's what I found wildly entertaining. It seems like the press and social media reaction to this was disappointment. It's like they wanted him to be dying.
Like, oh, darn
They wanted him to have flopped the cognitive test.
He's eating McDonald's every day.
No, that is so true. You know, when, you know, we talk about President Obama or Hillary Clinton, you know, the media that isn't the liberal media that we like to make fun of, they weren't hoping that they would die or be on their deathbed or anything like that. But the liberal media seems to take the liberty of being very, you know, vocal about, oh, man, you know, oh, really? So he doesn't have cognitive deficits, or how much longer is he going to live? And, I mean, we're human beings. When did politics get to the point where we lose our humanity and we want somebody to be dying or dead in office? It's ridiculous. And, you know, good for Donald Trump for having good numbers like he does.
Well, there was an element of that with Hillary Clinton during the campaign when she was collapsing and they were pretending like she had no medical problems. There was a there certainly was within conservative press an emphasis on the fact that, look, she's sick. She's not capable of doing this. She doesn't have, and Donald Trump, by the way, made that an issue during the campaign. But this is where we're at. Yesterday, the doctor comes out and says, look, he weighs 239 pounds. And people say, on what planet does he weigh 239 pounds?
He's
put the other foot on the scale.
He's pretty wide.
And I got to tell you something. The BMI was shy under the 30 cutoff. So a BMI of 25 to 30 is overweight. Yet once you're 30, it's obese. So he came in at 29.9, probably 99999. So you wonder if there was some fudging. But you want to know what? He's the president. Let him. How many of us take out our contact lenses before we get on a scale? He's going to probably do the same thing.
And the cognitive test, which Dr. Ronnie Jackson said the president insisted on and says he aced it. And again, this was all the speculation that the president's a lunatic and he's got trouble formulating sentences and putting words together and remembering where he is and blah, blah, blah. All that stuff that was in Michael Wolff's book, according to the doctor, not true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he took the Montreal cognitive assessment, and if we could say anything good about the Canadians, they really know how to evaluate for mental illness. So they had this sucker down, and basically it checked visuospatial, executive functioning, memory, attention, language, abstraction, delayed recall. It tests a lot of facets of someone's cognitive ability. So if somebody does have early dementia or Alzheimer's, they're going to fail some of these tests, like subtracting 7 from 100 serially, being able to listen to a group of numbers and motorly tap when you hear an A, looks at attention, you know, certain consequential. There's a variety of different terms we use with this, but it's not the simplest test, meaning if he did have issues, yeah, it would pick something up. So, you know, was it necessary? No. Does it prove that he's, you know, not going to hit the, you know, push the red button or make Kim Jong-un, you know, ticked off at him? No, but at least it kind of thwarts any rumors of him having Alzheimer's or dementia.
And we're talking with Dr. Dahlia Wax, drdahlia.com for all things Dr. Dahlia. So He's a tubby guy who likes to eat Kentucky Fried Chicken and Big Macs, and so do most Americans. And he plays golf, but he drives the golf cart right into the greens because he doesn't want to walk from the rough to the actual with his putter in his hand. So all of that, and people say, how could he be in good shape? And the reality is the doctor said, look, he's got good genes. And some people, I got two words for people who doubt that he could be in good health. Tommy Lasorda. Tommy Lasorda is 90 and he's still roaming around Dodger Stadium.
Big time. You're right. And
sometimes some people get away with it.
It's so true. So true. But okay, people are going to hate me for saying this. Donald Trump's on Crestor. Crestor or rosuvastatin is one of my favorite medications. And I got to tell you, you could eat Kentucky Fried Chicken dipped in butter and goat milk, and being on Crestor, your cholesterol will look pretty damn good.
This is getting perilously close to phone sex if you keep talking like this.
I credit the pharmaceutical companies and AstraZeneca and Crestor for keeping him alive and well. So watch their stock drop. But I got to tell you, Crestor is a good medication.
All right. Now, speaking of dropping, people are dropping from this flu. Different topic, obviously. But, I mean, there's been stories about marathon runners, 20-year-olds, getting sick and being dead 2 days later. What is this?
Oh, this is bad. This is bad. The H3N2 is a tricky one. It's a difficult one to make a vaccine for. And they were talking about how this year's vaccine in Australia was only 10% effective. A good year is about 60-65. So 10% effectivity really stinks. And then in America, they're projecting about 30% effectivity this flu season. But they said while they were making the H3N2, while they're making our flu shot, our trivalent and quadrivalent, the flu strain mutated. So it mutates while we're trying to make the vaccine. So then by the time the flu hits our population, the vaccine may not be effective the day it leaves the lab. And H3N2, it's the nature of the beast. It's a tricky one. And so, we're worried because the number one killer of people who have the flu is pneumonia. And so when you heard this 21-year-old weightlifter, really healthy-looking kid, say he had a cough and his chest felt heavy, you've got to always think pneumonia whenever somebody has the flu because that's what's going to kill him.
All right, Dr. Dahlia, as always, thank you so much. DrDahlia.com, Dr. Dahlia Wax. You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10. We're still trying to absorb, and I'm sure you've been on the phone with your tax preparer, about what do you do with the tax cut that President Trump signed that many parts of the country are celebrating, but not the high-tax states, certainly not in California, where we lost the deduction for the SALT, so-called SALT taxes, state and local taxes, which you used to be able to write off on your federal taxes. So essentially, you're paying taxes on your taxes. But there's a proposal up in Sacramento right now to add some pepper. We'll have the full array of condiments. And pepper would be the Prosperous Economy and Payer Protection Bill through Equitable Rates Act, pepper. And joining us right now to talk about what this is California Assemblyman Kevin Kiley. Good morning, Assemblyman Kiley. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
Can't wait till we get pickle relish and we'll get the whole mayonnaise, whatever you got.
Delicious.
Yeah, one step at a time.
This is Assembly Bill 1864. What would it do?
Well, this bill recognizes that we've lost most of the benefit of the SALT deduction, but we can restore it to California taxpayers with, what we're calling the pepper deduction. So the idea is really simple. Since you can no longer deduct all of your state taxes on your federal tax return, that's SALT, you should be able to deduct your federal taxes on your state tax return.
And the downside, of course, we know that your colleagues up in Sacramento and in pretty much any government office don't like giving up money. And this would poke a hole in the budget because they're counting now on getting that money. If all of a sudden it was sent back to taxpayers, the budget hole would be how big?
Well, it would, the exact number is a little bit uncertain, but based on a ballpark figure, basically it would just take the budget back to what it was about 3 years ago. And, I think that's perfectly manageable. And in fact, when you look at, with all the spending increases we've had in recent years, and then you try to figure out what if California has gotten return for that, what public interest does it serve, there's actually not a lot of evidence of all of that increased spending advancing any public interest. So you're right, it will have some budget effects. From the perspective of the individual taxpayer, though, these two things, the SALT deduction or the PEPR deduction, they're equivalent. It'll restore the full benefit of SALT, and it'll mean that no one here in California pays higher taxes as a result of federal tax reform. In fact, it'll mean Californians get a tax cut to the same degree as other Americans.
And what has to be factored in here, by the way, we're talking with California Assemblyman Kevin Kiley. You can follow on Twitter at Kevin Kiley CA. It's that simple. We're hemorrhaging population. I mean, the population of California continues to grow because of the birth rate, but we are losing taxpayers who move out of the state in large numbers, and people are not just taking their retirement money and leaving the state, but you have working families that are moving to greener and less expensive pastures, and that comes at a great cost to the California budget as well. So if there's a way to make it a little less, let's put it this way, to take at least one incentive for people to leave the state of California, that should be factored into the budget numbers as well.
That's absolutely right. And so I think that will offset some of the losses going forward. And it's a big, big problem. You know, in my district, I think everyone named someone that they know, a friend, a family member, an employer who's left California because of the high taxes and the cost of living. And so it will have some positive budget effects as well. And, we've been saying for many years now on my side of the aisle that taxes are way too high in California. And I think now with federal tax reform, we actually have an opportunity to do something about that, because we now have some common ground with the Democrats. You know, Jerry Brown and Kevin DeLeon have been very outspoken in the aftermath of federal tax reform about capping SALT, saying that it's a double taxation, saying that it hurts the middle class, it hurts California taxpayers. Governor Jerry Brown said that it's evil in the extreme. And so with my proposal, I'm actually giving them an opportunity to do exactly what they say they want, which is to restore the full benefit of SALT to California taxpayers.
Do you have any Democratic co-sponsors?
Well, I have recently, we only introduced this last week, but I have issued an invitation to Mr. DeLeon to co-author after his testimony last week. He said that he's very upset about SALT going away because it hurts the middle class. And so I've extended him an invitation, but have not heard back just yet.
Well, obviously, that would be a rare thing in Sacramento. We don't see too much bipartisan cooperation here. And frankly, I mean, I hate to paint with such a stereotypical brush, but the Democratic representatives in the state Senate and the state assembly have really not been particularly concerned about the taxpayers of the state of California. Many of them act as if the taxpayers are enemies.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you see just last session, we had this $52 billion gas tax that was passed and signed into law, which I'm now working to reverse. And so that's why it is kind of interesting to hear them singing a very different tune about SALT. Suddenly, there's this great deal of concern for California taxpayers when the pattern in recent years, at least, has been to keep raising taxes. And so that's why I'm sort of sensing this kind of unique opportunity here, where maybe we can point to some common ground that, everyone is unhappy about the tax effects for Californians of getting rid of SALT. So why don't we come together and find a way to make sure that that benefit's restored?
What are they? Can you offer us, those of us civilians who Sacramento makes the news when the Lakers are playing the Kings? And, you know, it used to make the news when the movie star was up there. But now it's unfortunately sort of fallen back into into just sort of white noise we just hear in the background. And it's a tragedy. It's the state capital, the largest state in the union. And it has a tremendous impact on our lives. But there's a culture there that everybody who covers it and everybody who spends any time there just sees this disconnect between what goes on in the councils of government in California and the reality. I mean, we've spent a lot of time this morning talking about the fact that progressive, enlightened, liberal, blessed California has the highest number of poor people in the country, both in real numbers and in, and in proportion of population. Not Mississippi, not Alabama, not those, you know, knuckle-dragging mouth breathers in the deep red South. It's us. And everybody knows this. And their answer to it is to try to raise the minimum wage as a way of, you know, bringing people out of poverty. And demonstrably, that ends up hurting the very people that they're trying to help. I mean, how
that's
is
absolutely right.
What is the disconnect? Why is it that you and I can see this and so many people can see it, but the people who make the laws don't seem to see it?
Well, I mean, a big part of it, Doug, is the influence of special interests, which I think, you know, have more influence in the California capital than just about anywhere else. To take one example, you know, when we look at why taxes keep going up, a lot of it is because of these special interests. Like the biggest spender on state politics by a long shot is the California Teachers Association. They were also the largest contributor to the last effort to increase the state income tax. So you have powerful special interests that relentlessly drive taxes higher, and then they use their influence to elect politicians who will then deliver them the proceeds. But to your point, you know, we have all this talk about how California is setting an example for the nation, but as you mentioned, you know, we actually rank last on a lot of very important metrics. As you say, we have the highest real poverty rate in the country, or an issue that I care a lot about is education. I actually used to teach at an inner city school in LA, and I serve on the education committee. And, you know, if you're a poor kid in the United States, the absolute worst place to be for education is California. And I see day in and day out at the Capitol how you have politicians who have opportunities to do things to fix that and refuse to do so. And unfortunately, that's because of special interests that are not looking out for California students.
Where does the money go? Because a couple of years back, it's probably 8-10 years ago, when Jack O'Connell was the superintendent of public instruction for the state of California, we had him on the show. And I asked him, and it was, I acknowledge it was sort of a talk radio kind of question. And I asked him, I said, if you could wake up tomorrow and have all the resources that you could dream of to run education in the state of California, preschool through PhD, what would that number be? And in essence, what we divined from it was more. That was the answer. The answer was more. Just whatever the number is, we always hear that we need more. And this is not just true for education. It's true for infrastructure. It's true for, you know, the courts. It's true for law enforcement. It's true for environmental protection. It's true for everything. And at some point, we have to ask, why is it we have a budget that's enormous with billions and billions of dollars, and yet nobody's ever happy? And everything seems to be lacking. The infrastructure isn't enough. The schools don't get enough, even though, you know, by law, it gets half the general revenue fund budget for public instruction. And yet it's not enough, and it doesn't get the job done. And then people have to shake their heads and say, well, where does the money go?
Right. Yeah, and that's kind of exactly my point with this measure, is when, you know, some folks might complain that this is going to, you know, lead to some loss of revenue. Well, it's only going to set us back a few years in terms of where the budget was a few years ago. And, you know, we haven't gotten any real return on those budget increases. And not to mention the fact, by the way, that there was a bill last year that passed the Senate, the single-payer bill, that would have put a $400 billion hole in the state budget. You know, what your point is exactly, you know, is exactly on point. And it's why, for example, I was so opposed to the gas tax increase that passed last year, is that we in California pay about 3 times more per mile of road than a lot of other states do. And so, and if we had, and simply used the money that taxpayers are already paying that's supposed to be going towards roads and infrastructure and actually used it on that, then we'd actually have a lot more money to fix roads without raising taxes. And you see that sort of thing across every single policy area. With education, exactly right. We have states that have much lower per pupil spending rates that get a lot better results, certainly a lot better results for poor students who California, you know, who perform worse in California than in any other state in the country. Healthcare is another area. We've about doubled overall spending on Medi-Cal just within the last 6-7 years. And where are the studies out there showing that the health of Californians has improved considerably. So you have this mentality that emanates from Sacramento that spending money is some sort of accomplishment unto itself, and there's no real concern for the outputs. And I think that's unfortunate because it's really caused our state to decline in a lot of ways.
You know, and if and we'll end on this point, but if it's been said that the Republican Party in its modern incarnation is anti-science, and that's a charge that the left throws frequently at the GOP, then I think it's fair to say, at least when it comes to Sacramento Democrats, they're anti-mathematics. Because because in addition to everything that we've discussed, we haven't even touched the gazillion-dollar question, which is the unfunded pension liability.
Right.
So we
right.
pretend as if we have any kind of a budget that is in balance in California when we're leaving an astronomer number off the table here.
Yeah, that's right. That is largely concealed from the public through accounting tricks and gimmicks, and it is it's left us in a very dire predicament that only gets worse and harder to correct the longer we delay.
And that's what we're doing. Hey, listen, thank you for the conversation. At Kevin Kiley CA on Twitter, California Assemblyman Kevin Kiley. We will continue to follow the path of 1864. It'll be nice if AB 1864 does get some Democratic support and put some reality to the rhetoric. Appreciate your time this morning, sir.
Thanks very much.
Okay. You know, we have had various proposals to split up the giant state of California over the years. There's a new one out. A proposal is to create a 51st state called New California, and it would take a lot of the Central Valley and San Diego Orange County regions, I guess, skip around L.A. going through Kern County, to create a new state of California. To talk to us about it right now is the New California Vice Chairman, Paul Preston. Good morning, Mr. Preston. How are you?
Good. How are you guys?
We're fine. Thanks for being with us. So what's this about? Explain to us what your goal is.
Well, the goal is to create the 51st state. What we're doing is we put the state on notice technically on Monday by announcing a declaration of independence and separation that we are going to be moving forward a group of citizens in various counties throughout this region that you are describing are getting together and coming up with a plan that will basically walk us through the constitutional process of Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution, which allows for a state split, a splitting off of a state to create another state in the union. And I want to make it very, very clear, this is not a secessionist movement. We are not trying to create a new country or anything like that. In fact, we feel so strongly about that that everybody who becomes a chairperson or any member of any city and county committee has to take the oath of office, pledging their oath and allegiance to the United States of America, just like you would if you were signing up to be in the military. So we are real serious about making it very clear that this is a new state. We're growing the union and making a better union as a result. And we think ultimately at the end of the day, both California and New California will benefit by this.
Now, it's my understanding the process would require the state legislature to agree to this. And, I mean, the obvious question is why would the state legislature agree to reducing their own clout?
Well, because they like their jobs and they're faced with a scary scenario going into the next 6 to 12 months relative to the California economy and revenue coming in to run the state budget. And as you know, Jerry Brown is starting to raid, in my opinion, STIRS and PERS and all the retirement systems now, voiding the California rule, so to speak, and also looking around for any kind of money he can garner because the state is running short of cash.
Well, we get all of that. I mean, we've been covering that for, you know, forever. And we get all of
right.
the flaws, the unfunded pension liabilities, the crazy train. We got it all. But just in terms of the mechanics of it, the state legislature, you're asking one of the most left-wing organizations in America, the California Assembly and the California State Senate, to agree to reduce their power and to add two conservative senators to the United States Senate. Why would they do that?
Well, you know, let's first back up and look at the process. The process of this involves citizens like we are the citizens who have made this declaration to work through our counties. And we claim no authority over anybody. We're just citizens following the Constitution, which requires us to work with the state legislature, not the governor. The governor is irrelevant in this process. And as we go forward and we start to reestablish or establish our county organizations, and we start to work with the citizens of all the counties, and we get them to realize the, especially with the configuration that we have now in the California map, the new California map, because what's in that map is our basis for representation. You know, in the other systems, like the Jefferson movement, they were trying to gain representation with 21 counties, but that just wouldn't happen. In our configuration, we've got North, Central, and Southern Californias, and we've got basically a lot of legislators now that are going to be, intertwined with that. We feel that we can run a successful campaign by the citizens as we start to go through this process, by the citizens working directly with the legislators to convince them that this is going to be financially and all the way around in the best interest of both North, New California and California. And that's the that is the proper way to do it. I mean, this is the system the founding fathers laid out. There's been other attempts, like through propositions. That's not going to work. There's been this notion of a secession. That's not going to work. The mechanism that has the best opportunity to work is the one that the founding fathers wanted us to use, that whenever we're forced into a tyranny, which is what we are here, which is a violation, which is of Article 4, Section 4, right now, the state of California is violating our constitutional rights to a Republican government, and they've created a tyranny. And that case will be so succinctly made by this group of people through a grievance process. 40 weeks of grievances we are going to lay out and make public to everybody in California and throughout the nation as to why they are violating Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, including the sanctuary state. We think that is absolutely seditious. We think that people have broken the law.
Look, you're preaching to the choir here. I get this. These are all issues we've been covering for 20 years. But I still go back to the mechanics of separating the portion of California that you're talking about from the rest of the state requires the state assembly and the state senate to sign off on it. And you're asking the left of leftist politicians to agree to create a state that would add more conservatives to the United States Senate. And I just don't see that ever happening, no matter what case. And by the way, I'm not even sure, and this is something that we've talked about many times, the state that was Reagan country 2 decades ago is now Jerry Brown country. And the reality is that the electorate in this state has taken a quantum step to the progressive left side. And I don't know that the argument carries weight when you look at the results of elections. We can't even get a Republican on the ballot in some elections.
Listen, the election system in California is so flawed. You cannot believe, I mean, the last two, ask Bernie Sanders how flawed the election system is in California. You know, when we start to sit down and negotiate with these people and we start to make our case, I think that this is going to be very, very evident that the position that they're going to be in the next several months, especially the next 12 to 18 months, it's going to be untenable for them. You know, they all like money, but guess what? They've now met their match. They've run out of other people's money, as Margaret Thatcher said. The moving around of the deck chairs on the Titanic is over. There are no more deck chairs to be had.
Okay, so the obvious question is, if your prediction is right, but at some point that is going to happen because the unfunded pension liability is what it is, and it's, the bill must be paid. But that's usually how the correctives come in. The left went too far. The House of Cards comes down, and then in comes another tide to bring in reform. You don't have to separate the state of California to do that. You just have to
The problem. The problem is that what we have and what we are offering in New California is a fresh start with a new constitution that is unbound by any of the things that California has right now. There will be no California Air Resources Board in New California.
Yeah, I know, but here's the thing. I understand that, but a lot of Californians want the Air Resources Board. When you put a green measure on the ballot, Californians, and increasingly across party lines, have voted to pay more for cleaner air and cleaner water and cleaner resources.
Then what we're saying there in that scenario is that we're going to continue to have more and more homeless people in California because the businesses will continue to flee California like they're doing right now. And, you know, under your logic, you know, in this whole stream that you're thinking, that many people want this green environment, which I don't buy at all. I'm a biologist. I get this whole thing going on. What I see happening is that under your scenario, your thought process, we're just going to continue to bleed people out of California. That is not going to happen. And I think people are getting fed up with that all across
the state.
Well,
listen, you know, I've been talking to Californians for 20 years, and people are fed up by it. But guess what? You know what they're doing? They're moving to Arizona and Texas, and the people that are staying increasingly agree with the kind of government that we have. And this is an unpalatable fact for conservatives, but it's a reality.
But that doesn't make it right. And
I'm just saying that New California. Hang on a second. I want to give out the website for you. NewCaliforniaState.com is the website to check it out if you want, folks. NewCaliforniaState.com. Look, I understand the frustration. There's nobody more frustrated by Sacramento politics than I am. It's a kleptocracy. But the bottom line is, the Kern County and Orange County and San Diego County and Tooele County did not create the state of California. And you've got to get the whole state to agree to this. And I just don't see what the economic advantage is to the remaining California to let New California go. I don't know why they would agree to it. They're cutting their own throats.
Well, you know, the problem is they've already slit their throat and they're bleeding out.
Yeah, but they're not going to stop the bleeding by letting a giant portion of the state of California go and lose the tax base of San Diego and Orange County and the agricultural business of the Central Valley. That's not going to help them. So there's no incentive at all. This reminds me of the Valley Secession movement that we had here in Los Angeles when Jim Hahn was mayor. And basically, the city of Los Angeles, the entire city of Los Angeles, had to agree to let the San Fernando Valley go because the San Fernando Valley did not create L.A. So they don't get a veto on whether L.A. stays united. The whole city had to agree on it. And downtown L.A. and the rest of L.A. said, we're not letting the San Fernando Valley go.
Here's your problem with California, and this is why it's so bad for them. Their business model and their ability to gain any kind of revenue is dead. It's over. And this is going to continue all throughout the state unless we take some sort of action.
Well, the action, of course, is
the constitutional action. The Constitution preempts everything, Jerry Brown and everybody on the left. We are taking a constitutional action to stop what they're doing because this is a tyranny that we're living in. Wow. And we are standing up and stepping up against that. And that's what we're telling the whole world. And guess what? People are responding to it because people are sick and tired across this state, across this nation, of what they're seeing coming out of California.
I know that you're hearing people say that, but there's no results in elections to back that up. When it's put to a plebiscite, the position that you hold and I may hold lose every time in a statewide election. NewCaliforniaState.com. Paul Preston is the new California vice chairman. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.